You're listening to the Allan Gray Podcast. I am Talia Patusi, a portfolio manager at Allan Gray and your host for this episode. Over the past 2 years, local asset prices have delivered exceptional returns, underpinned by a mix of political and structural reform optimism at home and unusually favorable conditions globally. But moments like these can invite an uncomfortable question. Are we really witnessing a genuine turning point, or simply another optimistic phase before reality reasserts itself? Today, I'm joined by my colleagues, portfolio manager Sandy McGregor and ESG analyst Rain Adams, to make sense of South Africa's reform agenda and explore several key questions. How resilient is the South African reform momentum story? And also, how exposed are local asset prices to current geopolitical shocks in the form of the US-Iran war? Sandy and Rain, thank you for joining me. Before I delve into the questions, I just want to highlight, Rain, earlier this year, you wrote a really thought-provoking piece titled Tipping Point or False Dawn, where you explored whether South Africa is finally on the cusp of a genuine step up in infrastructure spending, driven by this reform momentum in electricity, water, and rail, or whether this is just another moment that looks encouraging on paper, but struggles to translate into real change on the ground. And one of the elements I really enjoyed about your piece was that you didn't just look at reforms in isolation. You highlighted how this reform narrative has coincided with two other powerful tailwinds for South African asset prices. And those are firstly, very elevated gold and platinum group metal prices, which helped the Johannesburg Stock Exchange to deliver returns of 40% last year. And then secondly, growing confidence in a credible local 3% inflation target, which supported a second consecutive year of strong bond returns. Now, as we sit and discuss this today, and I must make mention, we are recording this with just over a month into the US-Iran war, and this war has led to some really large market downs as oil prices rise. So the market is now pricing for a medium-term unraveling of the 3% local inflation target, and we're seeing platinum group metal and gold prices fall. And this is not just undermining the local equity rally, it's also undermining National Treasury's corporate income tax collection opportunities, which are very important for bonds. So how I want to structure this discussion is firstly, let's talk about the reform agenda. Let's talk about progress. Where are we in the key sectors of electricity, water, and rail? You know, is the excitement about reforms cooling off? Are we about to see one of the big pillars that the SA asset price rally of 2024 and 2025 was based on being knocked down? And then I want to unpack the recent rise in oil prices, its impact on SA asset prices, and how it could have potential to knock down some of the other big pillars of the rally of the last 2 years. So to kick us off, Sandy, please let us know some of your high-level thoughts on South Africa's reform agenda.
There are two aspects to reform which we should consider. There's the fixing of things that are broken, and then also the structure of how things should be in the future. The institutions which have gone wrong, like Eskom, Transnet, large numbers of municipalities, used to be functioning, successful organizations. Eskom had a reputation as one of the best-run electrical utilities in the world. Transnet was sort of fit for purpose. And the municipalities in South Africa sort of operated reasonably competently. And Eskom itself has gone through a major crisis where it underinvested and its facilities broke down. And Transnet was in the similar place of underinvestment and mismanagement, pushing it into disaster. So now we've seen with Eskom that two big power stations which broke down and went out for about 2 years are now operating again, and they've managed to get the whole system going again, reasonable efficiency. So the days of load shedding seem behind us. So Eskom has been, in a way, fixed, but the question is where it should go in the future. On Transnet, which is a similar story, but they're only not nearly so far ahead as Eskom is, but they are starting to get to operate a bit better. So fixing those two organizations is on path. The problem is now, though, how do we run things in the future? How do we introduce the private sector into these management of these organizations? And especially when it comes to talk about the municipalities, which has so much impact on water and electricity reticulation, how should they manage and be fixed and be run in the future? These are sort of management problems which we've got to talk about. So it's in that context that some of the heavy lifting on Eskom, a bit on Transnet, and has been done, but there's a whole new direction which we now have to go into, and that's getting very complicated and much more difficult to do than just fixing things.
Firstly, I agree with Sandy. So I think on the supply side that Kusile and Medupi units being returned to service, plus the two last Kusile units being commissioned, have been a big contributing factor. And as he says, to a large extent, that's fixing what is broken. So I always like to contextualize problems and solutions and numbers. And if you just take those six units, four returned to service and the two new ones, which were finally completed after nearly 20 years of this new build program of Kusile and Medupi, then that's over 4 gigawatts of generation capacity, of dispatchable generation capacity. And in very simplistic terms, essentially each stage of load shedding corresponded to roughly 1 gigawatt of supply shortfall versus demand. So you can think of that in very simple terms as 3 to 4 stages of load shedding just there, right, in terms of what you've brought online. What I think people talk about less is the demand side of the equation, but I know the three of us have often discussed equally important, and I think people are less aware of that. So since load shedding, we've had this massive expansion in rooftop solar PV, for example, and then also embedded generation from the mining companies. So again, some numbers there. We've seen rooftop solar increase from just under 2.5 gigawatts 4 years ago to 7.5 gigawatts today, so tripling. And that has actually made a very valuable contribution. At the same time, because electricity tariffs have been increasing so significantly over the past 5 years, we've seen real damage to electricity intensive sectors like ferrochrome, for example. And so that has also just weighed on demand in that sense as well, on a less positive note. And so on that side, in 2025, we're actually seeing, for example, up to 2.5 to 3 gigawatts lower demand in 2025 versus prior years, prior to load shedding, where people started to innovate away from the grid. And so that's taken a lot of pressure off Eskom. Again, that's a very simplistic way to look at it, because what this actually means is you free up capacity in the day, for example, you can replenish your pumped hydro, you can replenish your gas peakers and things like that. So the implications of that reduced demand, just giving some more breathing room in the system, is very significant. So I think those are the two major contributing factors. At the same time, I do think it's fair to give some credit around improvements. And the main thing I would say there is management stabilization at Eskom. So I think it was no secret that in the prior, I think it was 16 years prior to the current CEO, Dan Marikana, coming in, Eskom had seen 13 CEOs, massive turnover. We saw similar turnover in chairmen of the board. And, you know, that's not great when you don't have that level of succession and trying to stabilize a company. So I hope this means we've seen stabilization that rights the ship to some extent. And then I'm more excited about, to Sandy's point, broader reforms in the sector that I think are taking place. And as he mentioned, the main one there is just the introduction of competition. I think it's happening slower than everyone would like, understandably, for the private sector, because you do need some momentum for private sector to invest and so on. But perhaps just a few things to mention there is firstly that NERSA has now granted electricity trading licenses to around 15 entities. And what they'll then do is serve as energy aggregators and traders in the system. So we're finding that, you know, the big energy users like mines could enter into bilateral agreements with a power producer and sign these long-term power purchase agreements, but that's actually not feasible for many smaller users. You don't want to carry that risk of a 20-year agreement. So these energy aggregators and traders will now come in and take on that risk function in a way, and I think help boost this part of the market. So I think that's positive for competition and time. Secondly, we were meant to have the launch of what is called the South African Wholesale Electricity Market in April this year. I think as many expected, that's been delayed. So it's now a soft launch where Eskom generation will almost start trading with itself in terms of the network transmission provider. But then they intend to open that up to other participants as well. And again, there what you're creating is more pricing transparency and a sense of competition to come through in the market. So to Sandy's point, I think we still have work to do, but I think electricity is on the right path. And now it's just about execution. I think the right ideas are there. There's been SAWEM training. So it's not like these are just concepts that aren't being unfolded, you could say. There's been wheeling structures agreed, grid codes, market codes, and so on set up. So it's a lot of work structurally, but I think that is taking place slowly but surely.
Thank you, Rain. And then maybe just contextualizing, you know, the reform story versus where we are now. Is it possible, do you think, that the current US-Iran war could derail our ability to roll out independent power producer projects at reasonable cost and in reasonable timelines? I mean, you've mentioned to me in the past, Rain, that the weak rand has made many of the bid windows uneconomic. Are we still going to be able to source conductors in a market heading for potentially serious supply chain dysfunction? Where do you think we are there?
So I think that's a really hard question right now. So I'm going to throw it over the fence to Sandy after I attempt to answer it, because we really don't know where things end up yet. As you mentioned, in the past, we saw with bid window 5, when we had those post-COVID supply disruptions and Russia's invasion of Ukraine, what that did to the bid window projects that had been bid highly competitively by that point, because this sort of auction system had been working, but then there wasn't much fat in the system. So when we had these disruptions, a lot of those projects ended up underwater and were not able to proceed on the tariff that they had bid. So I think it is a real risk if it continues. You mentioned aluminium. You know, that does factor into both solar and wind projects. But even beyond that, it's a material component of transmission. South Africa is also planning a material transmission build out. I think a huge part of our reform. So it's not a structural reform, but it's almost a reform underpinning a change in energy mix over time. And I think we have to think around that. But it's also just disruptions in terms of implications for shipping costs and lead times, because a lot of what we need for these renewable projects are imported. So I think it is a very real concern if this continues and escalates. Perhaps just on that note, something that I think is being less discussed currently, because all the news flow is being dominated by a US-Iran war, is that China is actually abolishing a 9% VAT rebate on solar panel exports from 1 April. And so that actually, considering that panels account for about half of solar project costs, is also another cost that's coming into the system. So given that we've been seeing a glut in supply of solar panels from China, and developers have been really benefiting from this globally, because China supplies 80% of panels, you know, I think this could be a tougher period we're going into for numerous reasons. And so just something to think about there that I think has been less on the radar, given all the US-Iran news flow.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem we face now is the price of electricity has gone up so much it's had a devastating impact on demand. And that Eskom's major problem coming, which is not one a lot of people discuss, is will it have markets for its power? We see this in this discussion with about having subsidized electricity, or not subsidized, cheaper electricity for the ferroalloy industry to keep that industry going. It's an example of what the sort of way we're going to have to think about power pricing, because if you just try and price electricity as we're doing now, a lot of industries become uneconomic. If something's expensive, people don't buy it. And so it's as simple as that. The whole pricing of electricity is an issue which what the actual market for electricity is very unclear. And the difficulty with all the discussions on the subject, people assume there's just going to be enormous demand for electricity. It's not clear that's the case.
That's true. And actually, I think what will exacerbate that is your large energy users and your paying customers are moving towards IPPs and bilateral agreements towards electricity traders and so on. And so Eskom's going to be more and more saddled in a way with non-paying customers. And we've already seen that despite the improvements that Eskom's made, they are now sitting with spiraling municipal debt of over 100 billion rand. And that's up from just 2.4 billion rand 10 years ago, roughly. So a great escalation in the problem that could actually undo some of the gains that they've been making if it's not brought under control. Eskom's putting in place what they call distribution agency agreements, where they actually try to sign contracts with some of these offending municipalities to take over things like revenue collection and billing, things that municipalities are really struggling with, to try and get them back onto a financial and operational path where Eskom can ultimately get paid. But it's not clear that, you know, that will always be accepted wholeheartedly. I think some of the municipalities are quite opposed to that. They see it as an overreach versus their functions. So to Sandy's point, I agree. I think it's a big worry for Eskom down the line, and certainly one they're aware of, is actually electricity sales in future and quality of customers.
That's actually such a great point, Rain. And it actually ties in nicely with the next question I wanted to ask, which is, I think there's this narrative in the media that, okay, Eskom doesn't really have a paying customer and, you know, the municipal debt arrears are huge. But, you know, renewable energy and independent power producers are going to save us from an energy standpoint in SA. So Eskom can just fall to the wayside. And I've heard you explain this quite well before. What baseload energy is and why it is important. So maybe just challenging that narrative that, you know, the independent power producers and renewable energy projects can just, you know, lift all of the load going forward. And then also what the SA baseload strategy going forward entails.
I think I should start with a disclaimer that I'm an accountant, not an engineer, just for anyone I offend with this basic explanation. But so baseload electricity demand is essentially the minimum level of electricity demand on a supply system that is sustained over a 24-hour period. In turn, baseload supply is dispatchable generation. So it's generation that can be available on demand at any point in that 24-hour period. This speaks to technologies like coal, gas, nuclear, and even hydro. So hydro is a renewable technology of generation, but it's considered dispatchable and it's a baseload in a number of countries. Then in contrast, you have the variable renewable energies, which is solar and wind. And in short, the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. So these need to be supplemented with baseload technologies. In time, batteries will start to fill that gap. As it is, you know, the problem with solar is that you get this peak at midday, whereas South Africa's demand profile is that we have peaks in the morning and evening. So you've got this mismatch with solar, for example, and yet we're seeing a strong build out of solar at the moment because grid connection capacity in the wind resource provinces is pretty much expired. There's no more left. So we're seeing more solar being built out. But of course, you don't want this profile that's mismatched. So over time, as we get more batteries onto the system, that can then be shifted, that excess capacity into the evening peak demand. But still, what this means is that from an economic perspective, just thinking of the costs of the system, for a long while still, we will be reliant on Eskom's baseload generation. And I think that's an important part of the equation because people say, well, independent power producers or IPPs can take over and Eskom can be allowed to fail. But in practice, it can't work that way because they're still supporting the whole system.
Okay, and maybe on that, what do you think their baseload strategy going forward entails? Is it just going to be a continuation of coal-fired plants?
Well, we've committed to, you know, just energy transition and associated financing. And on that plan, we are committed to retire about 8 gigawatts of coal power towards 2030. And our coal fleet is very old, with the exception of Medupi and Kusile. So they're actually, many of them are operating beyond their useful lives or close to that. So it sort of works in terms of their useful lives anyway, that they should be retired. In practice, what they are hoping will replace that is gas to power, and that we'll have 6 gigawatts of gas to power by then. But given where we are at today, in terms of progress, I think we would be materially behind schedule. And what we're seeing is a lot of environmental activism against gas to power and associated infrastructure you'd have to put in place that I think could significantly slow that. So Sandy, I mean, I'd be interested to get your opinion, but I think we're going to have to run coal power for longer than people realize.
We will have to run coal power for much longer. And the problem is a lot of these power stations are old. And so just keeping the whole fleet going is the problem. Ultimately, if we need electricity and we have a coal-fired power station, it's the only way we're going to get it. We're going to run the coal power station. We're not going to switch off the lights. The big problem, actually, the age of the fleet, and that requires very substantial maintenance skills in Eskom to keep that whole thing on the go.
Okay, and then maybe we could move on to water reform. So we know that access to water, and in particular clean drinking water, is becoming a major issue in parts of South Africa. Sandy, maybe I'll start with you. Do you feel like this is actually a bit similar to the issue of energy, because it's in large part also a problem born from municipal and local government dysfunction?
Yes, that's the problem Eskom has, of course, that's not being paid. But the water thing is much more than that. And the municipalities, basically a lot of them don't have the managements in them now, which have the capacity to run a proper functioning municipality. It's as simple as that. One of the biggest problems that they face has been caused this thing, is the municipal wages are set by collective bargaining with a municipal trade union from the center. And this has gone up year after year. The wage bill went up and up. They had to cut something out, and what they cut out was maintenance. So the structure of municipalities inevitably led to an underinvestment in infrastructure. And unless that's reversed, you can't fix the water crisis. What it needs is a lot of investment and skills to make that investment. And that in turn requires a reorganization of the way the municipalities operate.
And then maybe, Rain, your perspective on this. You know, what makes water infrastructure so difficult to fix? And then related, can you explain what's happening, you know, at an entity like Joburg Water and the water shedding and supply restrictions that are taking place in parts of the city?
Okay, so I think in terms of why is water so hard to fix, there's two factors there to consider, in my opinion. The first is just contextualizing the scale of the problem. So, you know, frankly, the water sector is in big trouble, and it's actually the area of reform that concerns me the most in terms of where it is today. Just in terms of some high-level stats, nationally in South Africa today, non-revenue water, which is primarily, it's unbilled water, but primarily lost due to physical leaks, is at 47%. The only province that's below the global average is the Western Cape, which is below 30%. There are some provinces that are over 60% on that, which is, of course, completely unsustainable if you think of the resources that are going into, you know, treating, pumping potable water. And then, as I've heard someone explain it, you've just got a leaking sieve, essentially. So non-revenue water is a big problem. Then you have water drinking quality. Fortunately, Department of Water and Sanitation, or DWS, reintroduced the green no-drop reports in 2023, which for the first time in a decade allowed us to see the true state of the water sector. Water drinking quality now, roughly 46% of our water supply systems record an unacceptable microbiological compliance, which simply means they pose a serious potential health risk. That's up from just 5% a decade ago. So a significant deterioration. And then finally, you have wastewater treatment works, where two-thirds of them now pose a high or critical risk of discharging untreated or partially treated sewage into the environment. And I think everyone's seen the consequences of that. We see it in rivers like the Vaal, Umgeni, and so on. So the situation is really concerning as a starting point, which makes it harder to fix given where we've got to. Then secondly, to Sandy's point, unlike electricity and rail, where you have a centralized national entity and national government is able to impose more in terms of reform strategy and intervention. In South Africa, your municipalities and multiple water boards are in control of water and sanitation provision. In South Africa, we have 257 municipalities, of which 144 are water service authorities. And so you start to get a sense of now you're having to engage with all these different entities to try and get it right. They're not homogenous. They come with their own issues. To Sandy's point, you know, some really lack technical skills. In the case of the metros, for example, their real problem is that they don't ring fence water revenues. And you raised Joburg Water. That's been a key issue there. So the revenue that Joburg Water has generated, very little of that has gone into maintenance capex, to Sandy's point. And water tends to be the one that's allocated last because you've got your underground pipelines and everyone thinks we can just leave it as long as possible. And still you start to see the implications of ignoring it. And a lot of that has gone into salaries at the city of Joburg instead. So exactly to Sandy's point. So I think that's just a key example at Joburg Water. At other municipalities, particularly smaller ones, you've got a lack of skills and therefore poor asset maintenance. There's a chart that the South African Institute of Civil Engineering puts out where they just show the dearth of civil engineers municipalities now, which is really concerning when you think of, as you say, the extent of reticulation pipelines, reservoirs, towers, and so on that are under their oversight. And then finally, I think at all the municipalities, revenue collection remains an issue. And so that's something we really have to get in hand. And one of the solutions that's been proposed for the water sector is, you know, try and create ring fence functionality in it. So create a special purpose vehicle or SPV, but then you still need your end customers to pay, because that is key to part of the success of the SPV as well. So yes, you can probably organize it with some larger industrial customers, for example, effectively. But when it comes to the end household, I think that culture of payment also needs to be developed. And that's quite hard to do.
And it's legally, it's difficult to cut people off from the water too. Electricity you can cut off, but water, no.
Okay, well then, Rain, I was going to ask this question, but I'm now almost too scared to, about whether or not you're seeing any green shoots in terms of water reform. But I think perhaps it's safe to say from the explanation you just gave that it's the slower moving of the reforms right now. Is that probably accurate?
I can definitely chat to some green shoots, which I think are encouraging, but it will be difficult to execute on. So okay. I think we can still expect to take time. But I think something that's encouraging, for example, is that we have a Water Services Amendment Bill currently sitting before Parliament. It's been approved by Cabinet. And that really draws a clearer distinction between water service authority and water service provider, which has been very muddied in the current local government sphere. So now the Water Service Authority will be able to appoint a water service provider. That water service provider must be licensed by Department of Water and Sanitation. And this really helps in terms of ensuring competence. So it can't just be anybody that the municipality decides. From there, if they are not performing, DWS has the ability to come in and compel the Water Service Authority to appoint someone else. And they can also take them to court to completely sort of override that if there's non-performance. So starting to give a little bit more power in terms of what you can do at a municipal level. But again, you know, it takes time to implement in practice. I think an interesting initiative or two that National Treasury has done, firstly, is that they've started withholding a portion of the equitable allocation to local governments that are not paying water bills. So it doesn't help with your arrears debt. It seems to be early signs that it's helping municipalities in terms of getting them to pay current bills due to water boards, which is really important. And then secondly, National Treasury has implemented something called the Metro Trading Services Reform, which is basically each of the 8 metros can submit a performance improvement action plan. Disbursements each year of this grant are then based on how they are performing on these KPIs versus the plan. And I believe there is going to be an independent assessment of that as well. So we're slowly starting to move towards a bit more pay for performance, pay for results. There is accountability around service delivery. And I think a lot of people would argue it's too late, but I think better late than never. So we have to hope that some of these improvements start to show up in the results. I'm also hoping there's more transparency around it, that they'll put up dashboards of these KPIs so that the public is more able to see what's happening.
And if I understand what you've said correctly, so, I mean, in this kind of future state, it's possible that a non-performing municipality would then lose their water license, and that license could be awarded to some other provider. I mean, who would that be? Potentially a private sector player? Is that?
Yes. Okay. I think they've not distinguished yet, as my understanding, could be either. I believe Rand Water is willing to offer those services. I think there's an SPV that they formed with Imfuleni, for example, to come in. But I believe they're keeping the door open. But private sector would definitely be a consideration there.
The difficulty is that the municipalities need leadership at the top. Now, if you pay your water, then you're not going to pay someone else. You haven't got enough money. That's the problem they have. They have demands on their purse, which now, okay, so you stop the corruption, but that's probably not enough. That's why these new municipal elections are coming up now are important in seeing whether we actually get some new people into municipalities who can run them better.
So I'd like to move on to rail. Rain, what is your sense of why Transnet is still behind on their annual rail freight volume targets? And then from there, I actually want to also discuss, are we about to see private sector train operators begin speeding up operational performance?
In the press, there's been a lot of focus, not so much recently, but over the years on, you know, the Chinese loco saga with Transnet. And of course, rolling stock has been an issue. But actually, the far bigger issue at Transnet has been this chronic underinvestment in the rail network. And that's both, you know, the rail itself and signaling equipment and so on. So what that means now is that even with improvements that Transnet's current management has made over the past few years, there's almost a cap on volume improvements that you can make, given the condition that the rail network is in. So there again, Transnet saw a rapid decline in volumes from over 220 million tons in 2018 to just under 150 million tons 5 years later. So, you know, it lost a third of volumes. They have managed to arrest that decline. So I believe in this FY 2026, so current financial year ending now, their volumes are back up to 168 million tons. But from here, it gets incrementally harder given the condition of the network. So I think they are facing a real struggle there. And I think they have work to do. But, you know, I suppose at least to management's credit, they are focused on that. I think they're working more with customers. So Transnet consists of 3 divisions, which is the 2 bulk export lines, coal and iron ore. And then the third is general freight, which is, you know, containers, manganese, vehicles, and so on. It's easier on the bulk export corridors because you have, you know, the coal users, the ore users forum, which is primarily Kumba Iron Ore, that can really engage with Transnet and have been on trying to find solutions. I think they've also contributed payment to independent technical assessments of the network. And so I think it's going to be an easier fix there. But the general freight business does worry me because you've got a lot of kilometers of rail. And I think it's going to take time to fix in some of those areas. And the container corridor, I think, just highlights the scale of the problem and really needs to come right.
In terms of, you know, private sector train operators, I mean, what you've kind of painted is a picture of the fact that if the rail line is degraded, it's not like they can just come in magically and, you know, save kind of operational efficiency.
Yes. Again, it's twofold because Department of Transport is enabling private sector participation in two spheres. So the first is private train operating companies being allowed access to the network. And then secondly is these infrastructure PSPs, private sector participation models, most likely concessions. And I believe the first RFP on this is due to come out to market in mid-2026, hopefully container corridor towards the end of 2026. And I know, I think even the iron ore and coal users are awaiting RFPs for their lines as well. And I think hoping to participate in that, for example, but very much wanting an integrated solution from pit to port. It's pointless fixing one part of the system and then you're still facing congestion on the other end. So in terms of the private train operating companies, 11 were conditionally awarded slots on all six corridors last year. But my understanding is there's still a lot to iron out there. I think that conditional award is very important, because I believe some of the T's and C's were very challenging in terms of the risks and penalties that would be imposed on the operating companies, given the state of the network. So alongside that, we very much need the infrastructure PSPs taking place, where you get companies coming in and hopefully fixing the condition of the rail. And I believe that will be in JVs, potentially with Transnet, where the private sector could even be a majority shareholder, depending on how that unfolds. I know there's been a unit set up at the Development Bank of Southern Africa, or DBSA, that's focusing on the framework around that so that we can try and roll these out constructively. But it does mean that in terms of actual volumes, I know there's been 20 million tons has been put in the press around this volume uplift that we could see from private operating companies by FY financial year 2026-27. I'm very skeptical about that. I know that one or two of the companies have said they hope to have their first locos on the network by early 2027, but I think we'll see a more gradual ramp up than some of what's been said.
Okay. And so to summarize, I guess in future state, we might see, well, we're going to see private sector train operators and then also private sector companies actually rolling out the infrastructure repairs.
Yes.
So in some ways, Transnet's role receding a bit.
Yes, and something to mention, which I haven't, is actually at the ports as well. So from 1 January this year, we had an international company taking over the operations of Durban Container Terminal Pier 2. And I think that'll be very interesting to look at the data, you know, in 6-12 months as to how they manage that port. It's a massively important port for South Africa in terms of our container volumes. And I think it just shows that these models can be implemented. And so it's a good one to watch in terms of what it leads to in the future as well, and confidence that it builds.
Okay, well, I promised we'd end this discussion talking about the other tailwinds beyond reforms that really drove SA asset performance last year and arguably even over the last 2 years. One being the 3% inflation target, and then also that big rally in platinum group metal and gold prices. And I think what we're probably wanting to discuss now is the fact that these tailwinds are fast being derailed by the US-Iran war and the spike in oil prices. So Sandy, I'll throw this question to you. So firstly, you know, why are platinum group metal and gold prices falling as oil prices rise? And I think this is a particularly interesting question because in conflicts and during times of war, we usually see gold prices rise and it's seen as a good hedge against war and inflation. So what's going on?
Well, talking about gold first, gold at $5,000 is reflecting a feature of gold, that it's money. Now, until 1971, gold was money. Then it was demonetized legally by the IMF, changed its status. And it became just a normal commodity. And its demand became basic bar hoarding and jewelry. And it grew very strongly because there's very strong growth in the price. Well, big rises in prices we've had were due to jewelry demand. But when the prices get very high, jewelry demand drops precipitously, you know, because you have a certain amount of money to spend. double the price, you buy half as much. So what we're having now is a very big decline in the demand for gold for jewelry and bar hoarding. But on the other side, in recent years, gold is again being regarded as money. The central banks now have come back to gold as an asset which is not someone else's liability. So there's very big interest of central banks in holding gold reserves now. That has transformed the attitude of people to gold. So the big run-up of gold now in this last period is because it was competing with the dollar. It was seen as money. Now, when the crisis happened, there's been a major shift of assets. The story last year has been, get me out of the dollar. Now the story is, get me back into the dollar, it's safe. And so there's been a major shift in this trade, which was to sell the dollar to where you want to hold your wealth is now in the dollar again. So, and that gold suffers from that. So that's why, for those two reasons, gold price is weak. Now, when we get through the crisis, these reasons why gold has worked will still be there. And so it can recover. These $5,000 gold price depends on lack of confidence in the dollar to, you know, be there. On platinum, it's different. The crisis has shaken the car industry. So this crisis puts up the price of petrol and it erodes the purchase of new cars, which in turn hits the platinum market. So the demand for platinum will decline. And also, major energy prices could push the world into recession. We don't know whether we're going there or not because it depends on the outcome of this war. But we're on the brink. And if it goes the wrong way, we could enter a major recession. And that in turn just hits the demand for platinum is an industrial metal, and that hits the demand. So the demand for platinum will decline, and therefore the prices go down. And so that's what's happening there.
Thanks, Sandy. And I think, I mean, another interesting point on gold, I think to me, it's just greatly ironic that gold prices are falling now, because in 2022 and that inflationary spike we saw after the Russia-Ukraine war, I know a lot of central banks were particularly upset because a lot of their reserves were in the dollar and US treasuries, and they did not hold their purchasing power in oil terms because they were selling off. So then post 2022, it became very popular for central banks to buy gold as a reserve asset. And they've been quite a strong underpin to the rally up to $5,000. But now we're seeing those same central banks who've now diversified their reserves more into gold come under pressure, in particular because of the high oil import bill, and begin to start to sell down that gold. So in a way, I think that's also driving some of the reason why it's behaving a bit like US treasuries and the dollar did in 2022. It's, you know, status as a hedge against inflation is actually being eroded. Yeah.
The number of countries that actually are selling gold, the central banks are selling gold, is really very few.
Well, we've seen Turkey and Russia.
Turkey and Russia.
I mean, Turkey's done about $8 billion worth of sales.
Yeah, which is, Turkey has the largest private gold holdings per person other than India. There's a huge stocks of gold in Turkey. And the country has more or less been, gold is its reserve asset now. So if you want money, you've got to sell gold because that's what you've got. And in Russia, it's the same story. It's the only thing that people will buy. So they're limited in what they're doing, can do. The interesting thing is gold is proving a reliable asset you can sell. And that's the important positive thing for gold in this.
Sandy, how do you think about the situation right now? It seems like we're starting to see rationing of electricity and fuel in parts of the world already, in parts of Asia, in Egypt. How rapidly do you think, this is a difficult question, the US-Iran war will be solved? And what do you think the potential is right now for supply chain dysfunction?
Interesting thing is that in a way you've got a sort of a snooker situation. You've got the Iranians have the hold on the straits, and it's proving very difficult to think of ways to break that hold. So they can permanently block the oil trade. If their infrastructure is attacked, they can bomb and destroy oil infrastructure on the other side of the Gulf. So they have a very strong position. The Americans have a strong position. They can bomb a large amount of Iran further and destroy their infrastructure, their energy infrastructure, and so on, create tremendous damage. So there's a point on where now, actually, the logical thing is that there's some form of a ceasefire and the war stops. That is the logical thing to happen. But these things can spin out of control. And you have participants on both sides who might make that possible. So we can't really say that's going to happen. But the logical outcome now is that there is in some form of ceasefire. And once a ceasefire happens, then things can sort of sort themselves out. These ceasefires do work. In Korea, there's a ceasefire in 1953 just to temporarily end the war. And it's carried on to this day. So it's a formula which has potential.
And then maybe why is South Africa particularly vulnerable, not just to the spike in oil, but, you know, the associated supply dysfunction and, you know, Gulf energy markets?
Well, this is our vulnerability. We get 60% of our petrol and diesel consumption comes from the Gulf. As products, we produce 40% of what we need from our own refineries, and which can probably get the crude and Sasol. The major shortage now is of a refined product. There is an oil shortage, but it's not nearly as severe as the crude shortage. It's not severe, especially as the Saudi crude's going out still across Saudi Arabia. So the question for South Africa is, can it actually procure, continue to import, as it has done, oil products? And it has contracts, has agreements, but they've been sourced up to now from the Gulf. So if Gulf continues to stay out of commission, we'll be the end, part of a long queue of people trying to buy up products. And in Asia, you're seeing already where panic buying by a lot of Asian countries. So this is going to be a real challenge. There can be very real problems. This matter isn't settled soon for South Africa. And we'll have to then start having to ration petrol or something, you know, and oil, diesel and so on. It's really complicated. You can't get it. Mm. It's not the price, it's availability, which is the problem.
Another question I wanted to pose is, you know, you're seeing the market starting to price the fact that this is undermining the South African Reserve Bank's 3% inflation target. So the market's now pricing for 100 bips worth of rate hikes over the remainder of the year, given the spike in oil. Whereas prior to the Iranian conflict, there was actually pricing for about 75 basis points worth of rate cuts. So that's a big swing in the opposite direction. And this, you know, complete 180 degree turn has underpinned this big decline in SA bond prices. I think as we stand now, since before the war broke out, we're down 7% on the all bond index, maybe a bit more. Do you think that the SARB's inflation target is now, one can sort of bin it?
No. Well, the SARB will stick to its mission. And the immediate consequence is that inflation goes to about 4% or a bit more. That was their number, and that was my number. So, but it's something that goes up immediately to about 4%. That's probably within the envelope of what they could do without raising rates. But what after that, anything that goes above 4%, then you definitely have a reaction from the central bank with higher interest rates. But you don't need massively higher interest rates. And whatever happens, this crisis comes to an end. Now, this is unlikely we're going to be in a major energy crisis in a year's time. The Gulf will have somehow or other reopened somehow. If it doesn't, well, then people will be building other, you know, doing things very rapidly to bring this shortage to an end. The market abhors shortages and acts to eliminate them. So once the energy crisis is gone, and it will go, and you must remember one of the problems with before the war was that we're heading into a major oil surplus. When the war ends, we'll probably be heading into a major, even bigger surplus now because there'll be more investment into the oil system. So then energy prices will come down. South Africa's is not a naturally inflationary economy anymore. It used to be. But it's now just like any other emerging market. And so there's no reason why we won't, once this crisis ends, gravitate back to a 3% inflation. And this is an interruption in the process towards a permanently 3% inflation.
Thank you for those thoughts. I thought as my closing question, you know, we've had quite a rich discussion around reforms in electricity, water and rail. And we've also discussed now at the end the impact of the US-Iran conflict on energy markets and SA asset prices. What is the key message you want to leave our listeners with today? Rain, I'll start with you.
I think firstly, just in terms of what is going right, I think something important to mention is that we're starting to get more of the right people in the right places. And I think you can see that with some of the ministers that we're seeing in the GNU now, I think has been very positive. And then also in terms of management teams at SOEs. So, you know, that is something that is positive and I think we should continue to cultivate. On the negative side, something I haven't talked about much, but I worry about a lot, and Sandy, you touched on corruption, I think, with the local governments, but is crime and corruption, and that this really continues to weigh on progress we're making. So I strongly believe we need to get on top of that urgently as part of our reform agenda, because otherwise I think it does hold back progress. But then finally, a closing thought from my side would be that reform is a process, not an event. I've heard that said, and I think it's very important, because we're starting to put together the right elements structurally, but now I think the pace and consistency of execution becomes critical. And in the past, that's where we've sometimes fallen short. We've also damaged our construction sector, for example. We need to rebuild skills, and I think we have to be realistic around timelines.
We face quite a big challenge now with this war. And I'd say this is the 9th crisis like this I've been through. Well, I haven't been through this 9th one, but I've been through 8 already. And what I learned from the previous 8 is you always get through them. These events are transitory. And so one must not lose focus that after this crisis, things can go start working out all right again. And the crisis itself might create incredible opportunities for some people.
Thank you to Sandy and Rain for joining me for this insightful conversation. If you would like to get in touch, please send an email to podcast@alangray.co.za. You can subscribe to this podcast on your preferred platform to be notified of new episodes. And lastly, Alan Gray is an authorized financial service provider. To view our terms and conditions, please visit alangray.co.za. Until next time, I'm Talia Patusi. Thank you for listening. And this podcast was produced by Volume Podcasts.
Imagine if you could save time like you save money. A second here, a minute there. Type a little faster, walk a little faster. Or you could stop scrolling on the internet. Just think of all the hours you'll save. Now, what if you could take all that time and invest it? Watch it grow. Until eventually, one day, you'd have so much time that you wouldn't know what to do with it all. But unfortunately, time doesn't work like that. It can't be stored or banked. And unlike money, you can't make it back. That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money, and then money gives you more time to do whatever you want to do, even if it is scrolling on the internet. Alan Gray, long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorized FSP.